the 1870s, that this crisis of liberalism, if you like, hit the Jews especially hard, wedded as they were to liberal political parties, which continued the traditions of the Enlightenment and emancipation. And as liberalism split, as I tried to explain to you last time, as liberalism split, the Jews were by and large deprived of a decent and meaningful power base. At the same time that you have the rise of these anti-Semitic mass movements. Then here certainly Arendt's analysis is quite correct. I then tried to illustrate what was happening through the movement associated with Stöcker and Stöckel in Germany, about which you will read more in the crisis book. At any rate, I tried to make clear that unlike the earlier anti-Semitic movements, these were no longer spontaneous riots, but more or less well-organized mass movements, that they found a formula which was to be a successful formula for producing a mass movement from the 70s and 80s on, and that formula was a combination of Christian social concerns and anti-Semitism. And that out of this combination of Christian social concerns and anti-Semitism came the various Christian social parties, which tried to appeal to the lower classes. If the conservative establishment was frightened by this and repudiated Stöcker, as I tried to make clear last time, still these movements had important effects. The Stöcker movement, for example, penetrated the student body and student movement, but it even penetrated the conservative establishment. And I cited to you the so-called Tivoli program of the Conservative Party of 1892, where for the first time the respectable Conservative Party called for a rolling back of Jewish influence in German life. They were affected. And though you have mass movements, you now have a two-pronged attack. One, in the mass movements themselves, and second of all, more and more in the respectable parties of the establishment. And I said last time, not only the Conservative Party with its Tivoli program, but also the Liberal Party, now National Liberal Party, were now infected with ideas of anti-Semitism, even if they did not go into the streets, even if they did not become and did not want to become mass movements like Stöcker, or still more important, like the Böckel movement, which I talked about last time. But the most important of these mass movements was not really Stöcker, who suffered shipwreck, too conservative, too Protestant Orthodox, not Böckel. Though Böckel may, if you remember, a fully furnished home for his peasants in Escher, and was therefore already a step advanced, but the Böckel movement failed as well. The most successful is the movement associated with Luger in Austria. And it is typical, looking forward a little, that the Nazis eventually heaped praise on Stöcker, built a museum for Stöcker, but that Luger is Hitler's example in Mein Kampf. That Luger, whom Hitler knew, under whose rule he lived in Vienna, in fact, for several years, was a man he greatly admired, even if he was too monarchical and not revolutionary enough. Luger, as you know, He called it, typically enough, the Christian Social Workers Party. And it was a party which tried again, successfully, to appeal to the majority in Vienna. From 1896 to 1910, he was indeed Lord Mayor of Vienna, and only his death in 1910 stopped him from being re-elected. But it is very typical that the first time he was elected mayor, in 1895, Emperor Francis Joseph refused to confirm him in his office. And incidentally, a little sideline, Sigmund Freud smoked a cigar to celebrate the autocratic savior of the Jews. 2 years later, in 1897, you couldn't stop him anymore. And in 1897, he indeed came to power. By the way, this story about Freud shows you something I told you before, how closely the Jews in Austria were linked to the Habsburg dynasty, and how relatively tolerant that dynasty was, refusing at first to confirm Nürnberger, but by 1897, it was no longer possible. Typically enough, the Christian Social Party was cross-class, like any important mass movement. Indeed, the appeal ran as follows. Workers of all classes, peasants, factory workers, teachers, employers, workers of all sorts, unite. Obviously a takeoff on Marxism, but this time not narrow proletarian, but broad and cross-class. He emphasized both the Christian and the social. His social program is again important for the kind of limits of social action of these anti-Semitic Christian social parties. What did he demand? He demanded no woman and child labor, no night work, the 8-hour day, comprehensive workmen's insurance and workmen's compensation. And with this social program, no women and child labor, no night work, an 8-hour day, comprehensive insurance, he also advocated the protection of private property and the protection of the family. This was the kind of mixture that was so appealing. The family, private property, and at the same time, a social reforming program. A typical program of the right. But that program by itself was never full. We went over that with Stricker last time. And so anti-Semitism is added. The Jew is the explanation why these reforms are not coming about. For it is true and significant that no more than Stricker did Nürnberger start out as an anti-Semite. He started out, like Stricker, as a social reformer, not as an anti-Semite. But he found, as he tried to build up a mass movement, that anti-Semitism pulled, and that indeed it was a good cement, especially in Vienna, with its influx of Galician Jews. It pulled, and pulled very much. The social program, and this is a problem, by itself, was never effective enough. At the same time, you get propaganda, a cult around Nürnberger. All the methods of propaganda, picture, playing cards. Playing cards are very important as propaganda. Remember what these people did in the evening. They went home and played cards. Playing cards, buttons, medals, the Nürnberger March, which my voice isn't up to it. And politically, universal suffrage. These are democratic movements. Reformist and democratic movements. The Jew is the exploiter always. And we have seen the foundation for moderation, for it is these Christian social mass movements which pioneered in that kind of total propaganda. But what made it a real success was Rueger's undoubted ability. He transformed Vienna, not only building up municipal transport, new building codes, he virtually eliminated the slums, new city planning, new parks, better public welfare. For the first time in any city, introduced electricity and gas, and all this municipally owned. In other words, there's a great deal of social in this. All this municipally owned, municipally run. His success as mayor cannot be doubted. He was probably the best mayor in his time, and from what I see, ever since. In a city where poverty and housing was dreadful, where disease was rampant because of bad municipal services and houses, Rueger's deserts were extremely great. Only his death in 1910 ended his reign and his re-election. His limitations are similar. This was an urban movement, and Rueger could never make the jump into rural Austria. In other words, he tried to become a national figure. He never made it, as Hitler was going to make it. He could never make the jump from Vienna into rural Austria. That was something conservative and Catholic, which he could never penetrate. Rueger's movement is certainly the most successful. It is much more important than Dreyfus, because here there was no civil strife, no disagreement. But you can see something else too, to which I shall come back on Wednesday. You can see how people like Freud and Schnitzler and Hofmannsthal and the whole Jewish intellectual ambiance in Vienna began to feel a feeling of dreadful insecurity. You can see how that would push them towards their creative and revolutionary path. This feeling of insecurity, being ruled by an anti-Semitic movement and an anti-Semitic mayor, however cynical Rueger was in practice. I told you, the famous phrase, "I determine who is a Jew," comes from Rueger. It was used later by Goering, but it comes from Rueger. So there was in it a great deal of cynicism on Rueger's part. And we can say here something that is true, that you all know is true. One of the great historical truths, which you must realize, that the soup is never eaten as hotly as it is cooked. And that great proverb, the general truth of life, as you well know. You don't know this proverb? That is why you're so excited about everything. Don't be so excited. The soup is never eaten as hot as it is cooked. That's life. So, then on the whole, there was under Rueger no active persecution. Sigmund Freud had his couch in peace. Nobody persecuted the man. There was no persecution as yet. That must be clear, because of the cynicism involved. And this is something, by the way, that Hitler condemns Rueger for in Mein Kampf. The fact that he was, in fact, a cynic, and that there was, in fact, largely no active persecution. But you can still see how the Vienna Jews would feel uncomfortable, would feel the disease, would feel the problem of where do I belong, with whom do I make contact, a problem, of course, to which we shall return quite clearly. These political movements, whether Rueger or Dreyfus or Stoecker or Berkeley, the irrational forces were in the ascendant, and central as she will have it. For one thing, it was much too episodic. If that was a mass movement, it wasn't half as successful a mass movement as even Stoecker or Buckel or Luega. In that sense, the anti-Dreyfusards are not the rehearsal for destruction. In that sense, because their mass movement, after all, as you heard about it in Arendt, was episodic, and we must not really forget it. The Catholic involvement was serious, because as you know, it were the Assumptionist fathers who were in the forefront of anti-Semitism and anti-Dreyfusardism. It was polarized against Jews on the one hand, against Catholics and priests on the other. But the point about the Dreyfus affair, about which you have read after all, is not, I think, that it is, as I said, a rehearsal for destruction, but that it happened in France. The shock of Herzl and Nordau, and everybody, we'll come back to that when we see the Jewish reaction, is that it happened in France, the country of the revolution, the country of the Enlightenment. The shock of the Dreyfus affair is not that the Dreyfus affair points to the future. It does not really point to the future. Luega points to the future. And the future is the same. The Dreyfus affair was in that sense too sporadic. There were riots, but not enough movement. And therefore, unlike Luega, Stoecker, and Buckel, the question was that it had no followers. There was no later political party that looked back to the anti-Dreyfusards, except for the Action Française. And the Action Française never made the breakthrough, really. So that the Dreyfus affair does not look to the future. But what it seemed to prove is the depth of anti-Semitism. Now, sure, that could have been proven in Germany and Austria. But somehow in Germany and Austria didn't have a French revolution. Somehow these were the countries where anti-Semitic thought had already developed. But the Dreyfus affair happened in the country of the Enlightenment, the country of the revolution, and that was the shock of the Dreyfus affair. And that, I think, is its main significance. It shocked Herzl and Nordau out of their assimilation. For this reason, where, after all, Luega, Stoecker and Buckel did not have a similar effect. It did not have a similar effect, because in Central Europe it seemed to be somewhat expected, but nobody expected the death of anti-Semitism in France. And yet, even in France, with it, while it lasted, it was more violent than the other mass movements, because it always had a putschist tinge to it. Anti-Dreyfusardism was always sort of putschist, riot-like, which was its weakness, but also led to the kind of violence. For example, we have nothing in Germany like the petition of the officers in France to try out new weapons on Jews. You have at the same time in Germany a famous petition called the anti-Semitic petition. But the French petition by the officers, the anti-Dreyfusard officers, asked to try out new weaponry on Jews. The German anti-Semitic petition merely asked for a rollback in Jewish influence in public life. But the meaning of this, I think, can be quite misleading. For the very violence in France was too early. It was too early. While in Germany, the fact that there was mass movement and little violence laid really a trend for the future. The Dreyfus thing was too early, too violent, too putschist, too riot-like, and it never became a mass movement. Therefore, it was more violent, but less important for the future. That is something that we must remember. And why is this of real importance? Because after 1900 we get a change that is very important. After 1900, anti-Semitism changed. It changed. For by that time, all these mass movements had in fact failed. And all the ideas of making anti-Semitic parties international, national, I won't bother you with them. There were many attempts to make an anti-Semitic an international, an anti-Semitic national. They had failed by 1900. They had failed. And because they had failed, political anti-Semitism after 1900 recedes. Indeed, why had they failed? Very largely because of the conservatives. The conservatives were still strong enough to fight these kind of movements, which were threats, mass movements. Violence was a threat to conservatives. And yet they had fought. In fact, you must realize that the thrust of the fight of the Christian Social Party, of the anti-Semitic movement, was against conservatives, not against the left. They fought against conservatives, their once allies, not against the left. For the matter of the left is too fast. Zwickel, for example, had social democrats in his movement. The matter of the left is a little fast because of the social in the Christian social. But what they fought was conservatism. And as yet, it is conservatism that defeats them. Anti-Semitism, therefore, after 1900, the temper changed. And what happens really is that for a while, theory becomes more important than practice. Theory more important than practice. For theory has also advanced, if you want to use that word, certainly advanced in sharpness. I don't want to spend much time on the theory, because we will read it in the crisis of German ideology. But what I want to point out is that while political anti-Semitism seemed to have failed in 1900, not in reality, but seemed to have failed in 1900, theory was ever more sharp because racism now for the first time really comes to the fore. And yet, the theoreticians of anti-Semitism, who were they? Fringe people, Lagarde, Dürer, Drumont. What were they really? People on the fringes of society. Two kinds of people. Either academic proletarians, that is people who aspired to academic positions but couldn't get any for a variety of reasons. Or they were something which became quite popular, wandering prophets. Wandering prophets, well, you know the same thing, provides again. Wandering prophets who went throughout the land preaching, who lived on almost nothing except their ideology. And they would be very important in this kind of preaching. Hitler first was one of these prophets. Wandering prophets through the land, living on nothing, preaching the doctrine. So what made them important? What made them important are perhaps two things. First of all, if they could get their books and newspapers to circulate. Until 1918, they hardly could. Their books, newspapers, were very little circulating. But what really made these rich people important is, again, if they could make a link with a political mass movement. And here the link really never snaps. From the beginning, these fringe people, these, what system, very largely. And links also to certain other political parties, even towards the Liberal Party. This was dormant until 1914, but it was still an important link. The fringe people were never that fringe. Their travels were sponsored, and they were sponsored, by and large, by agrarian conservative interests. But that is not all. A man like Turing, about whom you will read in the culture book, was sponsored by socialists and was so important in the socialist movement that Engels finally wrote a whole book against him, the Anti-Turing. So Turing, in fact, who was an academic proletariat, made links with the socialists for a while. And indeed, as we will see later, his thought did penetrate quite deeply, and Engels finally had to write the Anti-Turing about it. So they had to make it. Now the problem is, again, that in the Central Europe they made this link. In Central Europe they linked with the agrarians and conservatives for all their repudiation of mass movements. They made temporary links like Turing, even with the Socialist Party. In France, they couldn't make any effective links, only again with the Action Française, but nobody else. Not really with any what I would call important establishment interests. This was one of the great difficulties in France, that the links here after the excitement of Dreyfus were tenuous and were certainly much more difficult to make and were never made with this kind of success. We must notice that for all the link with conservatives, anti-Semitic thought and theory continues as a matter of democracy. Turing in Germany, Drumont in France, it's always again the same, and I must remind you of it. It is again the Jew and the exploiter. It is again the democratic impulse, which you also find in the Christian social movement, in spite of their being sponsored by conservative and agrarian interests. But this nature of the Jew is now his racial nature. And Turing summarizes it very well, which was not there before. The Jewish question, Turing says, would exist even if all Jews turned their back on their religion and converted to a Christian church. That is precisely now the point, the parasite of corruption. But there is another point to it. The accusation of the Jew now shifts, imperceptibly, but it shifts to the cultural realm. After 1900, political anti-Semitism. Then, so it seems, so it shifts to the cultural realm. And the accusation becomes more and more, not just the Jew as economic exploiter, but above all the Jew as the dissolver of culture. This is the essence of Turing. It is the essence of Houston Stuart Chamberlain, whom you will read about in the Crisis. It is the essence of Drumont. And that cultural emphasis, the Jew as the materialist who destroys true culture, that emphasis is vastly important, for it kept the anti-Semitism going, even when political anti-Semitism had fallen on bad times. After 1900, the cultural emphasis kept it going. To be sure, of all these people, Edouard Drumont in France is the most important. There is little doubt that is France Juive, Jewish France, in 1886 was of vast importance in starting the Dreyfus Affair. That is paper, his newspaper, La Libre Parole, that is the free word, founded in 1892, was vastly important He has the universal conspiracy. What he has that is different is again the Catholicism, which is typically of the French branch of this kind of ideology. It isn't really worthwhile to recapture his ideas. But Drouillon's effectiveness is great. Now we come to something in France which isn't realized, because French historians work exclusively on the left and are never interested in anything that happens on the right. Very difficult in French historiography. For Drouillon managed at one point to do something nobody in French France managed to do. For I told you that in France the Dreyfus affair was episodic. Drouillon was not. For Drouillon became, this is the only time this happened, Drouillon became the leader of a vast trade union movement of 500,000 members. By 1904, 500,000 members, called the Yellow Legion. A trade union movement which was anti-Semitic and reforming. In other words, his program was the Christian social program. Anti-Semitism was a part of it. And it worked as well in France as it did in Germany at this point. Better. For France is the only country where anti-Semitism became, for about 10 years, a sizable working class movement. Now you know why no French historian investigated it, eh? It became a sizable working class movement. Sponsored as usual by the railway workers, with whom Hitler also started, for National Socialism was at the beginning a working class movement. National Socialist ideas will begin among the working class, and only later become middle class ideas. But here, for the first time in France, is a large and important working class movement, which we call the Yellow Legion, movement which was joined by former revolutionists, part of the Blanquist, joined in and became, in fact, quite leading personalities. And they organized strikes. The biggest strike in Paris in the 1890s was not organized by socialists, but organized by the Yellows, the strike of Clochet, that is to say, the strike of transport workers in Paris, was organized by the Yellow and not by the socialists. And until 1934, the Paris police thought the Yellows were much more dangerous than the Socialist Party. So what you have here is, of course, a perspective that, after all, the fact of French historiography has to be adjusted, has to be adjusted. You'll never hear in France about that movement. And when I worked on it, it's very difficult for me to get started. Because in all these little socialist libraries, they always say, you don't want to work on that, better work on some other obscure socialist. So I made difficulty getting the material, of course. But still, 500,000 people is not the few of workers in the South. The man who started associated with the Yellows is, of course, Jean Jaurès. He broke with them, but he started there in the South with this trade union movement. So what you have here is a trade union movement of some importance. On its detail, I don't want to go into. But I want to make several points about it. First of all, the point is that in France, unlike anywhere, Christian socialism, in a sense, the Christian social program, they omitted much of the Christianity among their union activities. But the Christian social program in France is the only nation where it penetrated into a mass working class movement. And yet, secondly, it didn't last there either. And what is more important, it wasn't a precedent like Louisville and the organized less and less strikes, became more and more company unions. And therefore, the socialists, by 1906 or 7, the socialists had in effect defeated them. So that this was not an example for the future either, but it is something I will come back to and that you might so well remember. We must say certainly that undoubtedly, through this movement, anti-Semitism penetrated France very deeply indeed, as it penetrated the other countries with the mass movement. Again in France, as in Central Europe, the Jew and mass movement have become associated in an anti-Jewish symbolic way. And yet, in France, this was not to be a precedent. So that finally we must say that again, neither Dreyfus nor the Yellow One are really as important as I can tell up to this point, as important for the future as the mass movement in Central Europe. Neither really was taken as an example by anyone. You will find in the 20s the Nazis looking back to Luger and Böckel and Stoecker. You will not find, as far as I know, anyone in France looking back to Drouimont's organization of the Yellow Trade Unions. Nobody will really look back to that. And here again is a difference between France and Central Europe, which by which I really mean Western and Central Europe, which is important. Drouimont died, almost forgotten in the end. Totally, in fact, forgotten in the end in 1917. Finally, we must be clear that what we have here is then an attempt to beat liberalism. These are anti-liberal movements, but anti-liberal movements of the right, not of the left. And anti-liberal movements of the right, they became important mass movements, all important mass movements, which again meant an inclusion among them of what we would call Jewish faith, Jewish concerns. After 1900, the problem becomes changed. You get the cultural ideal to the foreground. You get to the foreground both racism and the accusation of culture. The accusation of the Jew with materialism. The accusation of the Jew with urbanism. And then I must remind you too that in all of this plays into a continuous what we talked about before, the accusation of the Jew as an urban character. The accusation of the Jew who comes from the city and robs the peasant of his land. Very popular literary theme, the one of the popular literary themes all over Europe. The Jew who comes from the city robs the peasant of his land and builds a factory upon it. The peasant then hangs himself, looking at what has happened to his roots. The Jew as the uprooter means the Jew as the destroyer of culture. So that again we must summarize in two words. First of all, political anti-Semitism never dies. It's underground. It revived in 1918, obviously. But secondly, after 1900, anti-Semitic theory shifts to race and culture, while not abandoning the economic factor. It ends in Zurich and in Grimmel with a strong cultural emphasis. Moreover, by 1914, anti-Semitism had become a mass movement, with more or less success in France, in Germany. It had penetrated classes, including the working class. Luega's support was largely working class. And that support is all classes. Its success has been its cross-class appeal and the appeal of social reformism combined with the anti-Semitic explanation for the evils of this world. The problem then is, what about the reaction of the Jews? How did the Jews react to it? And here we face two problems of vast importance. And I realize that I now get to things which are more personal to you. First of all, the reaction of the community, of what we call the notables. And secondly, the individual reaction, as much as we can typify them and look at the contours, which is difficult for many individuals, the individual reaction to it. So that now, for the next lecture, we must go to the reaction of the community and then the reaction of the individual in this difficult idea. Finally, one thing more. What's the matter with you? Aren't in your pants or something? One thing more. You misunderstood me at the end of the last time. Try to be as little personal as possible. But at the end of the last time, I did say that with all that we have discussed, there is a problem of Jews and mass movements. But I did not say that you should not join any mass movements, because that is exactly the problem we are now coming to in the next two lectures. What should the Jew do? Because the Jew, like everybody else, like anybody, wants community. And where the hell is he going to find it? That's going to take up next time.